Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic on Tour. Now, what could be more normal and pleasant and wholesome than a young lady becoming a nurse, wanting to look after her patients, wanting to work in their best interests? Surely such a person couldn't be cancelled, could they, by our regime, just for having opinions or trying to do her job well? Or so I thought, but then I was told about the case of my very special guest today, Miss Amy Gallagher, who is a political commentator and nurse to whom some rather interesting things have happened with regard to critical race theory and so on, and that's what I'm going to talk to her about today. So, Amy, hello.
Hello, thanks.
So, thank you for coming on. So, tell me first, before we go into your cancellation and your fight back against it, so where are you from? Where did you start off in life?
So, I grew up in South London, kind of Kent area, quite a working class family. So, my dad was a taxi driver. My mum was a cleaner, and I was the first in my family to go to university. So, yeah, pretty kind of boring background, really.
And you studied English, you said, in Sussex?
Yeah, so I studied, literature at Sussex. I did quite well at school, and I realised that I'm kind of quite creative. I liked writing, I liked ideas. So I did a literature degree, and I thought that it would be, I guess that's where I first started to realise that things were kind of wrong. I started to notice that what I thought university was wasn't what it was.
When was this?
This was in, this was in 2000 and, God, I can't even work it out now, like 15 years ago, whatever that is.
Okay.
Yes.
Right, hang on. Yes, so 2010.
Yeah.
What was it? What kind of things? Obviously, you're a bit younger than me. What kind of things were you noticing when you were at university?
Well, I didn't realise that the university I'd gone to was quite left wing. I didn't really have a conception of left wing or right wing. I guess I was liberal left by default because that's the sort of culture I'd been kind of raised in. Not that my parents were particularly political, but just that was the kind of, you know, everybody sort of thought like that. And then when I got to university, I kind of thought that if I, doing a literature degree, I would just like know the classics. I would, you know, understand literature better. I'd become more educated. It would enrich me and I'd have a better knowledge of art and so on. And I'd be a better writer. But what I found when I got there was that, I mean, a lot of the professors were extremely radical left-wing Marxists. I mean, I didn't really realise that at the time. I didn't have a conception of what that was. But I just noticed that some of the things they were saying and doing, I just thought, but that doesn't make sense. And I didn't really seem to think that the other students sort of noticed that. So I started to feel a bit like there's something not right here. I don't know. There's something that's not. Why are we doing this? Like when we were doing like Marxist readings of literature, and we were like, you know, trying to work out who's oppressing who. I was thinking, why are we looking at it in this way? You've never like explained to me why it is that we're doing that. And it was just a given that that's what you do. And I thought, but that's not what I came here. I wanted to kind of learn about every way of looking at something.
Right.
And it became very narrow. And so I became a bit disillusioned with academia. I was good at it. I did like a lot of woke, I did kind of woke essays that sort of got me good grades. But I just realised that it was a lot of, what I noticed was that the professors, they didn't seem very happy. And I sort of had this idea that if I went to university, I'd have a better awareness of myself. I'd have a better awareness of our people. I'd become sort of, help my personal growth. I'd become a sort of better person. But I noticed that these people were not very happy. And the ideas that they were teaching, some of them were even then ridiculous, you know.
What was the most ridiculous idea that you came across that you just reacted about? What the?
Well, there was start that I saw this kind of, the start of identity politics then. But I remember I had a Marxist professor who was extremely well-educated at, you know, Oxbridge and Harvard, and, you know, everybody looked up to him. And we was in a seminar and he was talking about essentially how, you know, communism is the answer. And he was talking about how, you know, he's totally anti-capitalist, communist is the answer to everything. And I remember a student who was trying to understand, genuinely, kind of who aligned with his viewpoint, put their hand up and said to him, you know, in this, you know, if we have communism, so we're all equal, we're all earning equal amounts of money and everyone's happy, what would happen to criminals? would there be a prison system? What would that prison system like look like under communism? And he said, well, under communism, there would be no crime because we were all earning equal amounts of money. Mm-hmm. Nobody would feel the need to commit any crime.
Because we're inherently all a black slave.
So, and I just thought, hang on, this guy, he's gone to Harvard and his kind of conception of the human condition is so off. You know, I just thought if you asked a random person on the street, you know, what would happen if we all earned the same amount of money? Would crime go away? And they'd say, well, no, because not all crime is about money. You know, we're driven by other things. And that's just like an obvious answer. But this guy has sort of been educated into stupidity, essentially.
People sexually assault women because of money.
Yeah, exactly. Or they kill their husband because they cheated on them because of money. I just thought, but none of this makes sense. And I just noticed that they were very uncomfortable around the people that they saw as kind of a... I remember that sometimes at the end of the seminar, like a cleaner would come in to clean the room and he would be so uncomfortable around the cleaner because you could see he's sort of Marxist kind of, how do I react to the cleaner? You know, she's an oppressed, you know, person and I'm a professor that's earning more than her and how should I talk to her? And he just was very awkward. And I just noticed that they couldn't just talk to people in an ordinary way. They had this whole kind of ideology going on and everything went through this kind of Marxist lens. Yeah. And I just thought, well, none of these people are sort of just spontaneously themselves. They're just not comfortable in themselves. No. And they, you know, and I just thought, well, I don't want to be like this. I want to enjoy
They have to have the mask to make them feel morally sort of superior in a way.
Yeah.
I suppose the cleaner confronts him with what he actually is like.
Yes.
He's not giving loads of his money away.
No.
His own hypocrisy, I suppose.
Yeah.
But so after that, though, I mean, you could have done anything with an English degree. You could have been a teacher. You could have gone into academia. You could have gone into anything, really. It's a degree. But you wanted to go to nursing.
Yeah, well, there's two. I mean, during my degree, I became very interested in literature that dealt with kind of mental health or ideas of madness. So I liked kind of the Shakespearean plays that dealt with madness. I became very interested in psychoanalysis and just the human psyche and so on. So that was kind of my interest. And then nursing became, I just also wanted to just get away from academia. So it felt to me was like, I just want to get away from these people. They're not in touch with ordinary life. And I just thought, well, nursing would be the, in a way, the complete opposite in that it's very selfless. It's just about helping people. It's not about ideology. It's a kind of it's a low status job, but I might quite like that because I don't like this kind of elite university people. So I went into mental health nursing. So I wanted to work with people who had, you know, psychological issues because I found it interesting. And I just thought that it would make me a lot happier than academia. So that's why I went into nursing.
Now, I know another chap, a chap I was friends with many, many years ago. He went to Cambridge and did, I know what, philosophy. And then he trained as a mental health nurse.
Right.
And he, or no, Latin, was it? And he found it very, very satisfying. But he's perhaps 10 years or 15 years or something older than you. Mm-hmm. So the kind of weird things that you experienced, he didn't. Had his experience them now, I don't know. But so tell me, so what was it that started to... pique your skepticism or your concern as you were training in the field of nursing?
Yeah, so it started off quite well, really. I really enjoyed it. I had many good years nursing. So I was working on an eating disorder ward for a long time with young women, teenage girls who were starving themselves. I worked on personality disorder wards to begin with. The ideology wasn't really there so much. Like you'd have to go to kind of an equality and diversity, maybe training once a year or something, but it wasn't part of the culture. But what I saw is this trans thing started to come through quite suddenly in the patients I was treating. So I had
anorexic patients.
Yes. So I had a good sort of, I would say, 5 or 8 years where it never came up. I never saw a patient who was identifying as the opposite sex. And I worked in all different wards. So I worked in psychosis wards. I worked on all different areas of mental health. And, you know, we're so obsessed with this kind of gender dysphoria thing, but it's a very rare diagnosis. I've worked with thousands of patients and I've never encountered anyone with an official diagnosis of gender dysphoria. But on with the teenagers I was working with, I remember when we got the first patient come through a female teenager who was saying that they were male and dressing like a male and trans, I guess. And this was a bit before it's such a hot issue as it was now. But I was quite surprised by how the ward and the other clinicians responded to this child, which was essentially to just completely accept that they are male. So there was two bathrooms on the ward, and they were given a male bathroom. So they essentially had their own bathroom, because eating disorder wards are just all female, essentially the patient group. And I could see that the other patients were kind of a bit annoyed about this, because they were thinking, well, this patient, female, who's saying she gets her own bathroom, and we all have to share a bathroom. And bathrooms on eating disorders are quite a big deal, because it's often where they go to self-harm or make themselves sick or try to get away with certain things. And they was just, you know, there was this, well, why is this person being, but it was something that couldn't be said, but I could notice that. And there was lots of incidents where this patient had a breakdown because they had to, you know, they were looking at their section papers, and their old name and their actual sex was on the section papers, as it would be on an official document. And nurses were having to try and manage this and sort of say, oh, you know, try to explain why they'd put the original sex on the paper. And also, I've noticed there was this very, there's a moment that stuck in my mind where a patient who had anorexia was saying, you know, she was saying she was fat, and people were saying, you know, saying no, you're not, and so on. And she was saying, but that's how I see myself. You know, you need to accept how I see myself. And people will say, well, no, of course.
Well, I identify as.
Yes. And then she said, but I won't name the patient, but she said, well, patient A, she says she sees herself as male, and you say that she is male. So why don't you accept how I see myself? And I remember the clinician who she said that to said, oh, that's a completely different thing. Your gender's completely different, and you know that. Don't be ridiculous. And I just thought, hang on. We've gone off the...
It proves it, doesn't it? It just demonstrates the point. It's the same thing. I had a discussion with these teenagers once, and I said, well, I'm a white man. Why I identify as black?
Yes.
Well, that's completely different. Why? Well, because sex is a social construct. I said, well, so you're saying race isn't? Race is a biological construct? Yes. Is that what you're saying? Well, no, race is social. Well, then what's the difference? And it's this idea of being... with children, and the children will say, I am this. And sometimes you have to accept they are, or they'll cry.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that. And it was like this narcissism, that if a person has a fantasy, a narcissist fantasy, I'm perfect, I'm great, I'm the emperor of China, and you must accept their fantasy.
Yes.
Then that's the ultimate narcissism, I think.
And this was happening at a time, I think, where there was just an erosion of authority in psychiatry and psychology.
Sorry, I know the borderline personality disorder, mm-hmm. Which seems to cross over with autism in girls, as I understand it, that they can go into a sort of narcissistic mode. They flip in different modes. Is that mm-hmm. what these kinds of girls were, or were they like?
So on the ward that I worked on, so eating disorders and personality disorders also cross over. A lot of these diagnosis is crossover, and it's quite hard to disentangle them. But you would see kind of going from extreme states of you know, extreme emotionalities. You'd see with some of the eating disorders, they'd become obsessed with not eating and calorie counting, and then it would switch to, they'd start eating, but then it would switch to self-harm, or they'd go through periods where they wouldn't talk to anyone, they'd just go mute. And then they become, and then they decide not, and everything, they'd have to write things down. And I saw, that was another thing I saw, the erosion of authority on wards, in that people would go along with that. They wouldn't sort of say, no, I'm not talking to you unless you talk to me. They would sort of, okay, well, can you write something down if you can't speak?
What, it's this, like, this is a way of what, like, power over
people? Yes, people.
And also, I suppose, moving between different states. It's almost like a schizoid state where you don't want to be with people.
Yes, but that, you know, it wasn't challenged, and that generally psychiatry and the psychiatric provision was becoming increasingly scared or unable to, or just didn't know how to challenge behaviours. But that was, I thought, well, hang on, that's the whole point of what we're doing, isn't it? Is that we're trying to role model to these young people how they should behave, and we're going to set boundaries, and they'll learn from the boundaries.
Mm.
But essentially, there was like, no, actually, we should mold ourselves around the young people. And I thought, well, hang on, well, then how are they going to change?
It's like a school where the children are in charge.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Isn't the idea that the medical professional is an expert?
Yes.
And that inherently sickness is not as good as health?
Yes.
and inherently delusion is not as good as understanding reality coherently.
Yes. Yeah.
And this is being turned on its head.
Well, it was being turned on the head. I mean, what I enjoyed about eating disorders is that we still haven't had a sort of relativism around eating disorders, and that pretty much everyone still agrees that you shouldn't starve yourself. You know, there wasn't kind of mixed opinions of that. But with the trans stuff, and even with personality disorders now, you are now seeing people who self-harm as people will say, well, that's their, you know, that's how they manage things. You know, that's, you know, who are we to challenge it? And you think, well, you know, I mean, with eating disorders, they will die if they starve themselves. So we haven't quite gone in the direction of saying, well, that's, they're allowed to just, you know, not eat. But with the trans and other areas, it was becoming more and more, if we can allow the person to do the thing that we all know, you know, is not good for them, then really we should, because that's kind of their subjective truth. And then I just thought, well, what is going on? And then I saw in the last sort of 5-10 years an explosion of the trans thing. So I just saw, you know, loads of young people coming through, all trans, none of them with an official diagnosis of gender dysphoria, not that I know that that would necessarily change anything, but they're all just saying that they're trans and everybody just going along with it straight away.
It's just the obvious. I mean, I heard that you get social contagion even with regard to self-harming.
Yes, you do, yeah.
So one girl does it, others do it. Yes. It gets them attention, or it makes them feel a sense of power or something like this. So controlled. So you've got it with this, though.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's also, obviously, the difference with the trans thing is that there was a culture that the society was also encouraging it. You know, it was seen as a good thing that you get virtue points if you're trans, you know. And it was, you know, oh, wow, isn't it amazing that you've come out and, you know, you go to Pride events, and there was all of that. So it was very hard. That's why it became so hard for the psychiatric profession to stand up to it, because they were struggling to stand up to anything anyway. But then when the whole society and the political class are saying, you know,
yeah. Well, yeah, you used to have a society, certainly when I was young, probably when you were young, that tries to push you along the sort of adaptive roadmap of life.
Yes.
And says certain things are bad, certain things are wrong, this is doing the opposite of that. It's pandering to a sort of narcissistic instinct where we're all gods and we can say, I am that I am.
Yes, yeah.
I am my identity, to the extent that it allows you to do your harm to yourself. I mean, this what's it called? This mind-body dysphoria where you think you're disabled, and so you chop your arm off.
Yes.
And so you harm yourself, and then the medical profession should be stopping you from dissecting such people.
Yes, yeah.
So this is madness, obviously. God. So how did it then sort of unravel in a way such that you got yourself...
So I started training to be a psychotherapist. So I liked the side of nursing that was kind of talking with the patient and building up a relationship and helping them through therapy. So I did my first 2 years at the Tavistock, which is now, well, partially shut down. But I did a psychotherapy master's there. And to become a psychotherapist, you need to do 4 years. So I returned after having done 2 years there, which went pretty okay. And I started the last final years to do the training. And essentially not that long in to that training, I was sent a lecture titled Whiteness, A Problem for Our Time. And this was advertised as, you know, it was a big deal for the Tavistock, because they'd had a 100-year anniversary, and this was seen as the lecture that they were going to celebrate that anniversary with, and it was so brilliant and wonderful. And it was essentially just critical race theory. And I saw on their website they were just going totally into critical race theory, that this is how we view race. And I essentially challenged that, and then I had kind of 2 whole years of bullying for doing that.
So is it what you challenged in a seminar or?
Yeah, there was also a lecture that I had to attend, which was about race and racism, and it essentially was an hour of Black Lives Matter are good, and you know, white people are bad, and here's all these instances of racism towards black people. And I was thinking, well, this isn't psychology, this isn't psychotherapy, this is just propaganda, this is just like a party political broadcast. And they were saying that racism, they were saying that Christianity is racist, and I'm a Christian, and they were saying that all sorts of things. And at the end, I just said, I just challenged it. I said, you know, not everybody thinks this way, and that's a problem, isn't it? Because there are some people that will disagree with the view that Christianity is racist, and as professionals we need to be aware of that. And I was quite shocked because the whole group just suddenly, it was like, you know, it was like I said something outrageous, you know, it was kind of that, you know, I'd really upset the apple cart. And then what happened after that was I challenged...
What did they say to you?
Well, I was expecting the person to say, of course, we don't mean the whole of Christianity is racist. You know, of course, we are aware that there's different viewpoints. But essentially, she just doubled down and she said, well, no, that's right. And I was thinking, oh, I was expecting some kind of apology or for her to sort of backtrack. And then so I wrote an email essentially saying in response to this whiteness a problem for our time lecture that, you know, we need to be aware that critical race theory, some people view it as racist, it's very racist towards white people. I mean, in this lecture, they were saying openly racist things. They were saying things like, white privilege was a given, but they were saying things that white people don't understand the world. All white people are racist. White children are racists. You know, it just kind of, you know, and there was no balance. It wasn't even like there is this thing called critical race theory, and here it's good points, here it's bad points, here are other theories that, you know, there wasn't a sort of a range of views. There was no consideration given to the fact that it's just totally unevidence based. You know, it was just presented as the truth. And I said, well, you know, in my email, I said, well, you know, we need to be aware that we may be treating patients who find these ideas offensive. And generally, I take the colorblind approach to race, that if I have someone who's sat in front of me, that really I take the view that their skin color doesn't really tell me anything about them. I don't really know what's going on in their mind based on their skin color. And the critical race theory is essentially arguing that you can. So you know that a white person is racist because they're white. So I know something about what's going on in their mind.
It's like saying you infer somebody must have low IQ because they're black.
Yes, yes. And also, as a white therapist, if I had a black therapist, that I need to be aware that they would be threatened by me. I said, well, I don't know that. I don't know that how they feel about me being white. You know, I don't know anything, actually, until someone tells me. So I sort of responded to it in that one. I thought that's quite an appropriate way to respond. I got pulled into a meeting by the course lead, and I was essentially told that if I was to carry on expressing my views, that I wouldn't be suitable for the course. And they said, this is an anti-racist organisation. I said, well, I'm against racism. I said, but my idea of racism is...
Yes. Carry on expressing you what they're supposed to, what they used to do. What lectures, yes. Academics like myself, get frustrated if I do a lecture and you say at the end, any questions? And you hope that it's interesting enough that somebody might ask questions. Mm. To be fair, normally it's a mature student, and you know, which you were, and it's considered among an undergraduate almost like only the nerds ask questions.
Yes.
But no, it's the mature students ask questions because the intelligence goes up with age until the age of 45 or something. And so the mature students are just inherently more intelligent than the undergraduates.
Yes.
They tend to ask questions. They're hard working. And the idea is you encourage it. Critical thinking, critically analyze, you know. And this is, you're saying that this was anathema.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I was taking that stance. I was saying, well, I'm a student. You're teaching me something and I'm asking questions about what you're teaching me. You know, and she was just saying, well, we are an anti-racist organisation. And I said, you know, is the views of this lecture, does that represent the whole trust? And she said, yes, it does. And I said, well, my view of not being racist is not judging a person by the colour of the skin. She said that was discredited.
So discredited?
Yes.
How did something that there's a theory with no evidence for it, simply an idea, be discredited?
Because it's discredited among...
There's no empirical evidence for it.
No,
it's
I know.
Just a way of seeing things.
I know. So I wrote a complaint about this. I wrote a complaint saying, essentially, look, you've made these assertions. I listed all the things they'd said. I said, well, it's racist because you're making judgments about people based on the color of the skin. And they said that they were looking into it and they were going to do an investigation.
How do you... When you say I did my undergraduate fieldwork on evangelical Christianity.
Yes.
My postgraduate fieldwork. So I'm going to ask, what kind of Christian? Would you say you're an evangelical Christian?
No.
What kind of Christian?
I'm with the Church of England, but...
Sure, but is it Anglo-Catholic? Is it?
Anglo-Catholic. Yes, yeah.
Right, but let's say if you were an evangelical,
yes.
You can see the parallels, can't you? That
yes.
If you get someone that turns up to an evangelical Bible reading, then there's a degree to which there's an accepted theology and an accepted praxis, and it kind of makes people a bit uncomfortable if someone's sitting there questioning whether God exists, questioning whether the Bible is divinely inspired, questioning whether there's substitutional atonement, whatever it happens to be. It's like, and it creates a bad atmosphere and people don't like it.
It's because they can't answer those questions.
But they can't answer those questions because what they're doing, what they have is dogmas, and they believe in those dogmas, and those dogmas give them a sense of identity and make them feel good and make them feel morally superior, perhaps in some cases, particularly of the kind of convert type, the William James religion of the sick soul type, where you that's the kind of religiosity we're talking about.
Yes.
And it kind of parallels, I suppose.
Yeah.
That this is a religion, and we're here to, in a sense, engage in an act of worship.
Yes.
And you are interfering with that act of worship.
There were so many aspects of the religious on this course. I mean, this Tavistock, they actually did a 9 minutes of silence for George Floyd to remember the 9 minutes that he was on the floor. You know, and he was like some weird kind of martyr. It was so bizarre.
A serious criminal that put a gun to a prisoner's stomach.
Yes, it was. We had to do 9 minutes of silence to think about this one man.
Life beater.
Yeah, it really bizarre. But yeah, I mean, they you know, when they said they were going to investigate what had been said and these racist ideas that I said, it seemed like they were taking it seriously. And essentially, they sent me a report that essentially doubled down. They essentially said that this is our view here and that I needed to go away and interrogate whiteness and that I needed to find a safe space in which to do that.
It's almost like someone saying, well, look, pray harder about it.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And it was always that it was always framed in that it showed that I had an inability to learn. So they were saying, you know, we can see that it's very difficult for you to be open-minded to these ideas. And you need to be able to sort of overcome that. And, you know, the learning process can be difficult.
Mm.
So it was my deficiency of not being able to understand these ideas. And I was saying, no, I understand them. I understand critical race theory. I understand critical theory. I disagree with
you
it.
You don't understand in their sense of understanding. Yes. Their sense of understanding is a kind of emotional, religious experience sense of understanding.
Yes.
Like an alpha course. We're on the last week of the course, you go away and have a religious experience, and that's when you really understand God.
Yes, I wasn't able to access an understanding of whiteness in the way that they were.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the... Yeah, so it went on, and they kept pushing these ideas. They kept teaching Robin DiAngelo, who is not a psychiatrist or a clinician, who wrote this book called White Fragility. And I was involved in a seminar where her ideas were being taught, and I disagreed with it again. And because I disagreed with it again, essentially they raised a student conduct policy against me. They said they threatened to remove me from the course if I continued to speak inappropriately about race. And I said, well, what have I said that's inappropriate about race? And they couldn't quote me on anything, but they said essentially it was your tone of voice, your tone. And then this went on, and eventually...
So just write everything down. Oh, then they'll say it's your linguistic tone. But yes, okay.
Yeah. So they raised the student conduct policy against me. I wrote a complaint about that. I was saying it's victimisation. One of the course leads a very nasty email saying I lacked maturity and that I was vexatious for disagreeing with the dogma. And eventually, there was just more and more bullying. And eventually, I was stopped from seeing one of my patients because I was deemed to be unsafe.
Patients, black patients.
No. I had two white patients, one of whom I completed my clinical work and it went very well. I mean, all of my progress reports said I was doing very well as a clinician, you know, in terms of my patient work. But eventually I was told, there was also another lecture I went to where, again, they were talking about whiteness and they said that psychoanalytic ideas were white ideas. And I said, well, what does that mean for an idea to be a white idea? And I was told that I had attacked that lecturer and that lecturer didn't feel able to return to lecturing because I'd said, what is a white theory?
Did you ask him to defend himself?
I asked what the...
Her?
They met herself. I said, well, what does that mean? You know, because I don't see how...
Right, so therefore you confronted them with psychologically. It's so interesting that you're dealing with people that are supposedly psychologists or psychiatrists.
Oh, I know.
You can officially be quite self-aware. You've confronted them psychologically with a cognitive dissonance.
Yes.
And confronted them with the idea that perhaps they're not as great as they think they are.
Yes.
And this had triggered them and all their childhood feelings of being bullied or God knows what. I don't know, some speculation.
Well, indeed.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So that went on. And then eventually, they stopped me from seeing one of our patients. So the reason they gave, I mean, at this point, they were just gunning for me. And I'd initiated a lawsuit against them because they were threatening to prevent me from entering the profession of psychotherapy. And there was an incident where I was with my patient and there was a loud noise happening in another room. And I went next door to ask if the noise could be lowered because it was interrupting the session. And they said that in doing that, I'd traumatized the people in the room and I shouldn't be allowed to be with patients, and that they would investigate me to determine whether I'm safe to be with patients because I traumatized people, and they said that I wasn't safe to be in the clinical reception area because I might re-traumatize people. And then essentially they said it'd investigate me to determine whether I'm safe.
What person was playing this loud music? Was it an ethnic minority?
No. It wasn't music. It was like a banging. And it was just like, I thought there was some kind of construction work going on or something. And it was just a session that was happening. And I didn't know what was going on. But they used that as a reason.
Sort of creeping concept, creep of the word trauma.
Yeah,
referring to be a specific clinical thing where something normally, even with the most neurotic person, something at least slightly bad has to happen to be traumatized.
Yeah, I mean, trauma now is they were just using it as you've just done something that we don't like. Basically, you've traumatized us. I mean, the course lead actually wrote in an email that I'd created a traumatizing learning environment because of my questions about the ideology. So this word trauma kept coming up.
But it was the tone of the questions rather than the questions themselves.
Well, it's complicated. When I initiated legal proceedings, I think they realised that, you know, it was very difficult to say that I'd said anything wrong. But then they just said that I had an aggressive tone, that the way I was asking the questions was oppressive.
Can you ask me the question in roughly the way that you did so I can know what it is? White people are racist and there's racist ideas.
How can a theory be white and what does whiteness mean? That's kind of what I was saying.
That's fucking aggressive.
Yeah. So, and then eventually one of the course leads gave a pre-written speech about me to the students in front of me. And she essentially said that it wasn't safe to be in a seminar room with me because of my oppressive speech, and that I'd caused an oppressive learning environment, so I wasn't safe to be in a room with, and I wasn't safe to be in a room with the patient either. And they were going to investigate me to determine whether I was safe, and that was 2 years ago, and the investigation hasn't happened. So that was it. That was the cancellation. Yeah.
How did this? Presumably, this was rather stressful.
Incredibly stressful. Yeah. Very, very strange.
Tell me some of the consequences of this.
Oh, I don't want to sort of play the victim too much.
No, don't play the victim. Just objectively and calmly.
I mean, I did have quite significant physical health problems, actually. I kind of had symptoms of panic, insomnia a bit for a while. Very, very low. I mean, as I said, I come from quite a poor background, and I'd put a lot of money and time into this training, and it was going to be my sort of career for my life. So it was devastating. And I think there was the loss of my potential career, but there was also, and still to this day, the kind of psychological, trying to get my head around how people could act like this and how people could target me in this way. It's sort of, I mean, I wasn't naive. I was, you know, I worked in mental health. I was aware of how, you know, the dark side of human beings, but still having gone through it, I couldn't believe that, and that so many of them sort of all ganged up on me. It was just a shock that they would do that.
But wasn't it based on your own learning in psychology and so forth?
Yes.
In many ways, actually entirely predictable.
Well, it's interesting because it was the thing that helped me.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask. Yeah. Are you ready for the future of the West?